Joining me for the January 2023 edition of Our Town is Robbie Wright. Robbie Wright's the head over there at HIAC, formerly Saislaw Broadband. And Robbie, I thought maybe we could sit there and talk a few minutes first about the situation of fiber, where fiber is in Florence, and how that project's coming.
Yeah, that sounds great. I guess to start off, we have fiber a couple different places over town. We started kind of going back in time here a little bit in 2018. We bought a lot in the Pacific View Business Park and built what we call a central office or a fiber hut. We effectively bury all of our fiber in the ground and bring all of them back to the business park. And so we have our fiber up and down Kingwood, back into Park Village, a little ways down Rhododendron, kind of past the sewage treatment plant, up Spruce, quite a few spots on 101 now. We've started construction on our first federal program that's going to take it all the way out in North Fork. And so we're almost up to Bender's Landing, kind of taking a left and hung a left up Munsell Lake Road, getting ready to wrap up Ocean Dunes right now. We have it kind of spotty all over town, and we try to pick the places where we know there's a healthy amount of demand before we go and invest our capital there. We're a small business. Neil and I privately own it, and we're not a giant multinational conglomerate. And so how we deploy capital is an extremely important thing for us. And so we tend to try to prioritize that to places we know that there's pretty significant demand.
How do you determine that? I mean, obviously, if you have 100 households, not 100 households are going to opt for fiber. So what is your... I'm assuming you have a goal ROI, when you go into a neighborhood. But what do you like to see when you're going in? What makes it feasible to do it?
Well, there's feasible is a good choice of words there. Feasible is like you hopefully can break even on the deal, which obviously isn't what we're after. We want to be able to see an ROI, especially when we're talking about the levels of capital that we have to deploy, which for us, on average, we spend about $30,000 a mile to hang it on telephone poles or what's called aerial construction. Or when we go underground, it's about $150,000 a mile. And so that Munsell Lake Ocean Dunes kind of example is perfect. Munsell Lake Road proper and most of North Fork is all aerial. And so the outlay for us there isn't as extensive as it is in the Ocean Dunes neighborhood. And so in Ocean Dunes, in a place where we have to pay into the six figures per mile, we look to try to have about half of the houses kind of pre-signed up, ready to go, and know that we have enough demand there. If we went into one particular neighborhood and you had 10 of 100 houses sign up, that wouldn't make enough sense for us from a return perspective to go deploy capital there.
When you have a situation like where you have existing utilities and stuff like that, are you able to access those current underground sources, or do you have to put in brand new?
Generally, no. And the longer answer is it depends on the area that you're in. Somewhere when that conduit got put in the ground, somebody owns it. And so it's really a matter of who owns it and where it's at. Florentine, Ocean Dunes, basically, if it's a neighborhood with a gate, the HOAs, for the vast majority of the examples here in Florence or most of Oregon, if it has a gate, it's not a public road, and the right-of-way is owned or controlled by an HOA. And so in instances like that, we see occasions where when the development was built, they put in extra conduit, and we're able to take advantage of situations like that, ultimately lowering our price. And we tend to offer free installation as an example. Most houses for us cost about $1,800. It depends on the density, but it's about $1,800 for us to pass a house and then about $800 to hook it up. And so if we have duct that's already in the ground, or we have 50% of the homes in an area that want to sign up for service, we're able to lower those costs for us to build, and we can pass that back to the people that are signing up.
So let me geek out a little bit here, because I want to understand the process. So you guys have your fiber in the ground in town. Mm-hmm. Now, when that goes back to your hub, what happens to it then? How is it distributed to, the actual worldwide web?
Yep. So for an ISP like us, it's all about one word, and that really is diversity. And on the coast, we're a little bit unique just because of our geography. We don't have a ton of options from a physical standpoint. And so for us, we kind of go two different aspects of diversity. One of them is what we call carrier diversity. And we have two separate carriers that we use to get us out of Florence. And in those two, between those two carriers, we have four distinct paths out of Florence. And so as for some additional information, the big Bonneville Power transmission, high voltage transmission that comes into Florence, that's Central Lincoln uses that brings power to the coast. There's a whole bunch of fiber on those poles, on those towers. And so if they ever had some major catastrophe or that fiber broke, we would only lose one of four paths. If the tunnel in 126 implodes or has a landslide, we would lose one of our four paths. And so for us, that path diversity and the carrier diversity, when we bring all of our fiber back, how we get back out of Florence is extremely important. And that's why we have our network architected like that.
Now, 100 years ago, probably nobody would have ever thought of the idea of, you know, having this kind of technology out there, Wi-Fi, you know, internet on your phone and things like that. So there is an idea that as technology grows, things will change a little bit. Is fiber the newest, best thing and long lasting? Or, I mean, is it 5G? Is there something coming up down the road? Or is this what is really going to be around for a while?
Yeah, the fiber technologies will be here for decades and decades and decades, 50 or 100 years, and fiber will be feeding the backbone of the internet pretty much everywhere. The downside to fiber is the expense. But compared to the other alternatives, 50 or 60 years ago, when you started putting in phone systems, or even earlier than that, and had what's called twisted pair copper, like a regular old telephone line, the physical limits of how much data we can pass over that is much less than fiber. And so the fiber cable itself is just the medium the data travels through, but all the speed and technology sits on kind of either end of the fiber with the lasers that actually shoot the optical signal down. And so today at our office, we have a 10 gig connection at the HIAC office. And if we wanted to, we could upgrade the lasers on either end and take ourselves to 40 gigs or 100 gigs to connect us back into other places in our network. We could go to our upstream carriers and buy bigger internet connections. And so the fiber that actually goes in the ground or hung on the pole, that's where a significant amount of the capital outlay comes. So 5 years from now, 10 gig might be normal at everybody's house. It's probably not going to be the case, but right. 5 years from now, if everybody has 10 gig at their house, for us, it's a plug in a new modem basically, and that's it. The fiber's still good. Everything's fine. You mentioned 5G. 5G is almost going to require more fiber. On the 5G side, they use higher frequencies that can push more bandwidth, but those frequencies travel less of a distance. You know, to sound like I know what I'm talking about for radio stations, it's like AM versus FM. AM signals have a longer wavelength and they can travel a further distance than FM, but you trade quality in that. That's why FM and, stereo radio sounds different than AM. It's using more bandwidth, but the frequencies are shorter and they don't pass through mountains as well, or sometimes they don't penetrate buildings as well. Yeah. 5G is exactly the same. 5G is extremely high bandwidth, high throughput, but you have to have those radios and antennas every couple hundred meters. And they use so much bandwidth, the only way that you can do what's called a backhaul, you basically have to take that connection somewhere else, you have to feed them with fiber. And so when you're in the Eugene Airport or the Portland Airport, and Verizon or AT&T has their 5G antennas inside the airport, all of that gets backhauled with fiber to a central place at the airport and then back out to the rest of the internet all on fiber.
So they still need fiber.
Absolutely, yes.
That's cool. Now, let's talk a little bit about this low-interest loan that is going to help facilitate rural communities. Talk a little bit about the difficulty or the challenges in getting that secured.
I mean,
obviously, it was not an easy process.
No, not so much. As most everybody could imagine, anything with the federal government generally comes with some strings attached. This is actually our second federal program now. We did the first one a couple, 2 years ago now, the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. And it was a program ran by the FCC. Completely different rules and concepts. They used a reverse auction idea where if you were a contractor, you say, I'll build you a shop for $100,000. And then I go to another contractor that says 90 and a third one that says 80. And the FCC runs this reverse auction until nobody wants to bid that low for an area. And so we have already started construction on that. And the second program is the Reconnect program from the USDA. And it is a long-term 20-year 2% loan that is designed to help offset some of the expense to get to really rural areas that might not otherwise pay for themselves if you had to use a market rate, kind of cost of funds or market capital rate. That low interest rate is designed to help offset that expense. So we'll pick on Sweet Creek as an example. The reason you don't see any other ISPs out there is the cost to get there is just so extreme for each of those houses, the ROI would be measured in decades. And so even for a small ISP like us, you know, we're a little bit of a hybrid because, you know, we're small and, you know, local here to Florence. So we want to see our community get access to the tools and equipment that it needs. And so we're willing to make some longer term investments than maybe some of the large telcos are. But at the same time, you know, we can't sink $20,000 just as a throwing a number out there to go hook up one house somewhere on Sweet Creek, because you ultimately would never get your money back for an investment like that.
Yet the overall, what's the word I'm looking for? The irony of all this is that the large telecoms probably have the money to do it and to sit and to wait for their investment to come to fruition. And yet the smaller companies are the ones that are taking the risk.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're what's called an overbuilder. And so when you have a traditional phone company like CenturyLink, you know, they have assets all over dozens of states and lots of Western Lane County. They've sold a bunch of those things and have restructured a couple different times, but their ultimate responsibility is back to their shareholders and who expect a certain amount of return. And if they can keep their customer churn, how many people they sign up versus how many people they lose, you know, in a reasonable spot, and they're not spending significant amounts of capital, everybody thinks they're okay. But even Charter Spectrum now, I can't recall the exact numbers, but here a month ago or so, maybe they came out and said they were going to spend $8 or $10 billion on network upgrades, and their stock plummeted that week. And so, you know, if you're a rural customer of Spectrum, you might be excited to hear that they're going to deploy a bunch of capital. The shareholders, not so much. Stock took a nosedive. And so we see a lot of overbuilders like us tend to be more local. They might be a local power company. A new one, Beacon Broadband, is Coos Curry Electric's kind of fiber ISP offshoot. And so they're down in the southern parts of Coos Curry. And I have gone after many of the same federal programs we have, but they're a local power co-op. And so their ability to make investments and their return expectations are different than a publicly traded company.
How does the streaming aspect of fiber work? For example, if you have internet through Spectrum, mm-hmm. you get the Spectrum, you get the TV channels, you get all the multitude of things that they have there. When you're a privately owned company, how does that work? Do you have to piecemeal things, you know, like people have to buy certain aspects of it? Or do you have something coming down the pike that might include, you know, a whole network of stations?
A couple complicated answers to that one. In years past, we have looked at offering television service. However, the cost for that, even for a small company like us, is more than a couple houses to purchase, even the houses in Florence now. And so the capital outlay for us to do that is extreme. And the margin that we make on that is sometimes measured in single digits. And so for a small company like us, it just doesn't make sense to be able to roll out our own TV package. However, that is changing. And we are actually beta testing kind of a streaming partnership with DirecTV right now. And so more than likely, it's not a for sure thing, and we're still kind of doing some testing. But more than likely, we'll end up with a streaming type device in somebody's house. They can stream everything over internet. And from our perspective, what's been surprising to me, the biggest challenge of taking somebody off of a traditional Dish Network, DirecTV, Spectrum, cable TV box and into a YouTube TV or Sling or a Roku or Google Chromecast or whatnot is the lack of a TV guide and like a regular clicker. Mm-hmm. And so we think we may have found something kind of cool with the DirecTV offering that we can give somebody a set-top box and a regular remote control, and they can get a TV guide and flip through the stations like they're used to doing.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. So we'll see. We already offer phone service, and so we kind of can do the double play. We're not quite at the triple play thing yet, but the vast majority of our customers that are coming to fiber recognize the value that we bring to the local community and the extensive speed. And so most people are already moving to streaming solutions, HBO Max or Paramount Plus or any of the, you know, what seems like, you know, 42 of these different streaming services now.
And it's developing too. I mean, it's constantly under development with many companies trying to find ways to get the fiber customer, you know, to get on their program and stuff like that. So I'm sure this will develop as the years go by.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It'll be what, picking on a DirecTV or a Dish, they're realizing that they can use other people's infrastructure to deliver their product and they don't have to pay for it. So like DirecTV doesn't pay us to use our internet, our customers do. And so I think as other traditional carriers recognize that the internet is a cheaper method of delivering their product. That's why you see more of these really large entities going after a streaming service. And then it really comes down to like content distribution rights and things you probably know more about than I do on how they do copyrights and, you know, royalties and all that.
It's a complicated process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Little old Hayek, you know, we can't go negotiate with the Pac-12 to get a Pac-12 app on a Roku station for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Whereas people, DirecTV is a bad example because they don't carry Pac-12, but a Dish or Xfinity or Spectrum or one of those guys, they're able to negotiate at a high level and get the right TV station content that most small people can't.
So let's go back to the $10.6 million loan, low interest loan. There's about 1,400 customers per se, maybe some businesses, a few farms out on there. Obviously, you've looked at the build out for that. Do you anticipating having to use a significant portion of that, or do you plan on getting in under the wire?
It's going to be close. we budgeted pretty carefully, both kind of covering us from having to outsource all of it to third-party contractors, but also balancing some of the construction in-house for ourselves. We try to trade off speed and cost. Our costs in-house are a little bit lower, but we can go faster using subcontractors. So we try to dance that line very carefully.
So where you can do it quickly and easily, you'll do it. And then where it's someone else can do it more quickly and easily because the amount of equipment they have or the type
Absolutely.
Of equipment they have, then they will take over.
Yep. Yeah. Like as a example, there's a stretch on 126 that's about a mile long of underground, which normally we could do ourselves. And it's all rock. And we don't have the right type of underground drill to drill in rock like that. That drill with a full load of all the tools and accessories you need might be $750,000 to do that. And so that's not a piece of equipment that we're going to buy, but we can have a third-party subcontractor come in and just put our conduit in the ground, and then we take care of everything else.
So are you a Beaver or a Duck fan?
Generally Ducks.
Okay. So it's like a run-pass option. Herbert's got the ball in his hand. Eckler's off to the left here. He's heading down. All of a sudden, there's a bunch of people in his way. He pitches the ball off. That's kind of the same thing, right?
Pretty close, yep. Yeah, okay. When we...
I like myself.
That's a perfect example. There's lots of situations like that where we run into maybe some kind of tricky underground. Most of the time it's underground.
Right.
Aerial stuff's pretty straightforward. But in this most recent program with ReConnect, there's a significant amount of environmental review. And this is kind of back on the paperwork side of it. We had three of us working on it internally for quite a few months and hired a third party grant writer who had some USDA experience. And so ultimately kind of that teamwork for us and our willingness to pay attention to all the small fine details helped us get into that application process and be successful. But there's significant amount of work for us still to do. We don't have our paperwork completed. We're still going back and forth with the USDA on that. We expect that to be wrapped up maybe the end of January, sometime in February. Just lots of T's to cross and I's to dot. The environmental review is a really large undertaking. Depending on the nature of the situation, we work on some tribal land sometimes, and so coordinating with the tribe becomes a very important thing. A lot of our stuff goes over, it was right immediately adjacent to the river, for example. And so since we're in existing right-of-way and we're going on poles, that's all pretty straightforward. But we have, I think, two or three Siusla River crossings that will go on existing telephone poles, but we still have to cross the river. And that means Army Corps of Engineers and Coast Guard and, more paperwork.
Do you have environmental issues that go along with that as well? Do you have people going, oh, you can't do it here because you're going to affect this species of, stuff? Has that come up in there?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a pretty significant species review. Again, this is just dedicated towards this particular program. But snowy plovers,
right.
are an issue on the beach, but not necessarily where we're building. There's bald eagle stuff in there, and there's the Pacific Martin. My business partner did the environmental side of this, but there's a certain type of squirrel and some variety of a marmot type animal that is eluding me now.
That you can't mess with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like if you see one there, it basically is a full stop, and then you have to go kind of through a different process. But the big benefit we have is we're not like net new putting in some backcountry crossing through national forest. It's all along the roadway, all on existing telephone poles. And so from the environmental perspective, it's a previously disturbed right-of-way, which makes our permitting process quite a bit easier.
All you're doing is hanging an extra piece of fiber on.
If we were hauling, like I said, from trying to think of like Herman Cape, and you were trying to come from Herman Peak Road and way up on top of Cape Mountain and trying to go backcountry over all this national forest, you'd have a way different process. So the fact that we've actually got through all of our environmental reviews already is huge. There's an ISP that won a similar program here 3 or 4 years back, and they were in environmental review for 18 months or 2 years before they even ever saw a dollar get released.
So when do you foresee running the first string of fiber in the rural areas?
Well,
for this particular,
that's a great million-dollar question. My guess is probably sometime in Q2 of 23, like April, maybe. We'll have our paperwork finished up here. It's pretty much done now, but we have a few more.
But 2023 is reasonable.
Yes. Okay. Yep. Yeah, we're pretty well prepared. Pretty well prepared for that already. So we've been working on it for a little while, and we're pretty excited. Kind of ready to get going.
Well, and I tell you what, I appreciate you coming in. This is the kind of stuff I love to talk about because I just love to figure out how this stuff works. So yeah. It's good to have you here.
And we love talking about it too, and love being able to, you know, participate in investments that help further our community and kind of help put the greater Florence area on the map.
All right, hear that, everybody? Invest your cable stuff in Hayek. A little commercial there for you. Thanks, Robbie.
Thanks, George.
Coming up next, I'll speak with Mike Miller from Public Works, find out what's happened last year and what's up for this year.